This may be too much for a blunt instrument to understand. Any thug can kill. I want you to take your ego out of the equation.
So you want me to be half monk, half hitman?
I knew it was too early to promote you.
Well, I understand 00s have a very short life expectancy.
Welcome back. Welcome to the James Bond Complex. I'm Matt.
I'm Edgar.
And now this episode, we're going to discuss the long-awaited, it's two episodes in for us, but the long-awaited Casino Royale 2006 movie, finally.
Finally, I'm thankful that we no longer have to wait. I think you and I have been waiting to do this one for a few weeks already. we got through the book. But now we get to the good stuff. Not that we didn't like the book. We enjoyed it thoroughly, but I think what's coming up over the next hour or so is going to be quite interesting.
Yeah, it's pure love. I rewatched it, and the first thing, having read the book and now watching the movie, that they did a lot of padding.
Yes. Well, it is, along with, I guess, Majesty's and Spectre, it's among the longer of the Bond films. It's more or less like 2 hours and 20, something like that. So there's certain, and the book is barely 150 pages.
That's
so.
What I meant. They padded the book. The book, last night I was rewatching it again, and I only watched the first hour, and I realized the first hour is completely superfluous almost to the complete narrative of the film.
Fantastic, fantastic first hour. But I agree in so far that it's extremely well made, but it's a lot of setup. Like, what exactly is going to get us to the card game? Well, it can't just be a little flashback to M's office who's speaking with Bill Tanner. We got to put some action in there. We got to put a little bit of sex appeal in there. We have to introduce a new James Bond, since when this movie came out, a new actor was portraying the role, Daniel Craig. So there's a lot of work to do before we get to that card table, that Hold'em, that Texas Hold'em poker, I think is what they're playing.
Yes, it is.
So it's I would agree with you that it's padding, which sounds like a negative comment.
I know.
In relation to the book, but it is such delicious padding.
It's delicious padding, but it just, as I watched it, I watched until the scene where they're the body of Solange, and they're investigating, and they're realizing that Le Chiffre was behind all of the explosion. And that's when I realized that you could have, as a opening sequence, him stopping the terrorists, and then you skip to them investigating the bombing, and poof, you're off. You could have easily skipped the entire first hour and a half and have the same.
Oh, that would have made it like a McDonald's trio, whereas we get like the five-course meal. We get, in fact, I guess the plot of this movie, or the story of this movie, is how James Bond becomes the character we know and love. Of course, how he gets his double. And literally, the movie starts in a gritty, everybody's using that word these days, that gritty black and white sequence where, how do you get a 00? It, not only is it shown to us, for those of you that still don't know, it's actually told to us by Dryden, you know. Mm-hmm. Your file shows no kills. And to become a 00, it takes two. So it's shown to us, it explains. That's what the pre-title sequence is of this movie, which I think is a brilliant coup. I mean,
you know what? I know I sound like negative. I love the movie.
Far too much. I'm very disturbed. We're like 5 minutes in, and I'm already worried.
No, it's my favorite, but it's just I was trying to see it from another perspective when I watched it last night, and having just reread the book, it became evident that a lot of this movie is padding. And I'm sorry to say that. And we're talking about the 00, how he gets his 00s. And even that part doesn't have any impact on the narrative. You'd expect them going through an origin story that him getting his 00 status would, especially since they were rebooting the character in the franchise, it would have been, it would have had an impact on the narrative, and it doesn't. It's completely not related to the mission that he goes on later on.
Well, it is and it isn't. I'll go to bat for that decision insofar as I think the mythos of Bond is so intricately linked to the 00 status. Like, is the fact that he's a bit he rushes into things a little bit too much, that he's overly cocky, that he has to learn some valuable lessons, which comes through the betrayal of Vesper. Does that have anything to do with the fact that he became a 00? Probably not. It's one of those things where I think it's just there for dramatic like heft. Like, he's James Bond 007. Everybody calls him 007. So let's, us being the filmmakers, let's tie all that in together, even though maybe realistically it doesn't have anything to do with it. Here he is. He's a newly promoted 00. He looks to be in his mid to late 30s, but we're sort of just going to pretend that he's kind of young and he's a bit of a hothead and he's running all over the place and he needs to learn some lessons. So I think they're taking the story of a beloved character, they're giving him something of an origin story, and they're including that 00 status. Narratively, I think it still works well enough, even though, yeah, sure, I agree. I mean, they didn't have to do it. He could have been a 00 for years already, but a bit of a hothead, you know.
Well, they could have shown him getting the 00. That could have been the parkour chase. He kills one man and then he kills the other. That could have been him getting the 00 status. He kills two. Well, technically, he kills three within the first hour. He kills, not counting the pre-title sequence, he kills the terrorist bomber, the parkour guy.
Molaka?
Yeah, that's his name. He kills the
Dryden, the guy in the bathroom.
No, not counting those two.
They suck. Who cares about them anyways?
Yeah, not Fodder. Bathroom. Yeah, he kills Solange's husband and
Dimitrios.
Yeah. And the fake cop bomber that gets.
Yes.
So he kills only those three people in the first hour. You could probably combine Dimitrios narratively, Dimitrios and the. I don't like where I'm going. I'm noticing these things, and I'm like, oh, geez, I'm ruining my favorite Bond movie.
No, I don't think you're ruining it at all. I think what we're doing here is we're exploring a different avenue the filmmakers could have taken, which is always an exciting idea. Do I think Casino Royale is the height of the art of cinema? Yeah, sure, I do. But that doesn't mean we can't conjure up other avenues that they could have taken. And I think the one you're presenting is interesting. It might have been an even tighter way to have us discover how you become a 00.
Yeah.
And it would have been more intricately linked to the plot per se. I don't think that means you don't like the movie as much as you did. You're thinking. You're using your gray matter. It's fine. It's perfectly fine. Please.
It would have made the movie tighter, but they're still like gorgeous sequence. I mean, just the parkour sequence.
The parkour sequence is a great action sequence, period. And I think in the context of the Bond franchise, it's one of the best we've ever been given as fans, as moviegoers. It's spectacular. It looks beautiful. I mean, they're doing this under like blue sky and sun Madagascar, but I think they actually filmed in the Bahamas, if I'm not mistaken, but whatever. We'll say Madagascar. And it's, again, going back to the idea of developing the character of Bond, Bond is not going to lift himself up and horizontally shoot himself through a tiny little window. He's going to burst through the thin wall, because that's sort of who he is right now in this period of his life. So I like how that sequence is. It's exciting. It looks fantastic. The stunts are magnificent. And it's letting us know a little bit about who this version... He's a little bit rough around the edges. He's not Sean Connery. He's not Roger Moore. He's pre-Roger Moore. He's pre-Sean Connery, He's a little rough around the edges. And I like that sequence sends that message while being a terrific chase in its own right.
No, he's a human tank. But I love in that sequence is that, and it's a characteristic that's in all of the James Bond actor is that he Malaka exerts himself further than he needs to avoid being caught by Bond. He's always finding these nooks and crannies, and he manages to jump and blah blah blah. And Bond, instead of going down by sliding the on the walls and doing a Spider-Man, basically Spider-Man shit, yeah. he's just going to look at, okay, where I am? Oh, okay, there's this thing. I'm going to smash the compressor and the little thing that I'm on is going to fall on the ground and I'm going to catch up to this guy. He's finding shortcuts to get where he needs to go. And that's a characteristic, that's a skill that I always appreciate about the character. He always finds his own way to get his way.
Yeah, well, he's a quick thinker.
Yeah.
And I think Bond has always been a quick thinker, whether it was by using a gadget in his pocket or his physicality or being a quick tactician to get out of a tight spot. And again, it's developing that character in a bit of a more brutal way because he gets banged up quite a bit during this. He does get his man. He does get Malacca in the end, but he's better than Bruce by the time it's all done.
Yeah, he is.
But I do like the moment with the compressor to sort of just, I don't know, they're on not a high rise. I don't know what you call a crane. I think.
There's the little thing that lifts the crane. I think he unhooks a bunch of pipes that
right,
and he zips up and the lifting, he breaks some type of compression or something in the unit and it makes it so that the cart falls down.
I know I can't run and jump like this bloke that I'm trying to chase, but there are these other tricks I can use, and it's very, you know, it's very Bondian. I mean, if you pay attention to how the character often gets out of these situations, you know, it's like the Goldfinger scene in the pre-title sequence where the guy's in the bathtub and he has his gun. Just he tosses, I think it's a fan or a lamp maybe, into the tub. Just quick thinking like that, the guy's dead. So it sort of harkens back to that as well. He's a very quick thinker, which is an awesome. That's why we love Bond. I wish I could think about it. I don't have to chase Malacca around the streets of Montreal, thankfully. But if I had to, I would like to have Bond's ability to find other ways around problems. And
yeah, no, the quick thinking, the immediate reaction. There's always a way, and if there's not, there's no other way, well, there's the Bond way.
And he has a strong will. So I think when there's a will, there's a way.
Mm.
And when there's a Bond will,
there's a Bond way.
Malacca can run as long and as hard as he wants. Unfortunately for him, he's eventually going to get caught. Do we want to talk a little bit about the plot? We talked about padding.
Mm-hmm.
So how did they pad it? What's the plot of Casino Royale? The 2-minute version, not the 2-hour and 20-minute version.
Oh, okay. I did the book. Do you want to try to do it for the movie?
I'll do it for the movie. So essentially, after being shown how Bond gets his 00 license, we're presented to a character by the name of Le Chiffre, who's played by Mads Mikkelsen, and he's presented as the banker to the world's terrorists.
I love that line.
A great line. And in this particular instance, he is a banker to some, quote, African freedom fighters. One man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. And they give him a ton of money. By the way, there's a Mr. White lurking in the background. He'll come back in this movie and in a couple other ones. So they give him the African freedom fighters give Le Chiffre some money, and he decides to take that money and bet against the market by betting against the stock price of an airline that are soon to be unveiling a brand new, incredible airplane. Bond, through various complicated means, comes to discover this plot, foils the plot, but that's not the end of the movie. That's like an hour of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's foiled Le Chiffre's plot to bet against the market, Le Chiffre, kind of like in the book, he's in financial straits, shows up at Casino Royale, sets up a high-stakes poker game, and Bond is sent to outduel him there. Successfully, albeit not without difficulty. And through that, he falls in love with an envoy from the Treasury, a Vesper Lynn, played by Evergreen. Oh, goodness me, played by Evergreen. They fall in love through this. He gets his thunderballs rocked in this one, in this version, too. And but it turns out Vesper was working maybe for the other side. So there's betrayal, like in the book. She does not die like in the book, but she does get her comeuppance in the end. And Bond has learned a valuable, valuable lesson, you know, trust no one. And that's basically how the movie ends.
Yeah.
That was a little bit more than 2 minutes, but it's a really long movie.
It's a very good movie, too. So I guess we could start by the main characters. We have Bond, we have Le Chiffre, and we have Vesper. I have to start with Le Chiffre because...
How can you not?
He's such an improvement to the book.
I suppose our friend, Mr. White, will have told you that I have provided reliable banking services for many other freedom fighters over the years.
Do you believe in God, Mr. Le Chiffre?
No. I believe in a reasonable rate of return.
Yeah. Well, hey, take the floor, man. Tell us why you love Le Chiffre so much.
I love Le Chiffre because I love him more than the book version, but I love him because of the actor portraying mostly. I love Mads Mikkelsen. Am I saying that right?
That's how I say it, Mads Mikkelsen.
Mads Mikkelsen. Because he's such... he's a bit... what I imagine is his background was probably... He was bullied as a child. And that's probably all he got his scar. His scar on his face. That's,
you're a nerd. You like math. You know.
Basically, he probably helped people cheat. And that's... He probably his entire life had other people.
He helped them cheat, but for a profitable rate of return.
Exactly. He probably, all his life, he had to make deals to get, because he was bullied, he got into this situation. He probably had people backing him up. That's all. He probably got invested in criminal organization, and he feels like he's somebody who was bullied, his entire life, and that's where he is in life. And it's there's not an arrogance, but
I think there definitely is a bit of arrogance. He's you know, apart from maybe when Bond shows up, he's the smartest guy in the room.
He's the smartest guy in the room, and also he disregards other people. Like, he's really self-centered. He's very when the freedom fighter track him down to Casino Royale, and they threaten his girlfriend, and he does nothing. Mm. I'm like, yeah, you're a sack of shit.
Yeah, oh, you very much are indeed a sack of shit, Monsieur Le Chiffre.
He's so despicable. That's why I like him, because he does not care about anyone but himself.
Yeah, well, what I kind of like about the way they handled the character, and I think it does come across a little bit better in the film than in the book, although you do get a sense of it in the book, is the fact that he's the villain of the film, but he's a bean count. Like, he's dealing with these African freedom fighters. He's dealing with Mr. Le Chiffre, Mr. White, excuse me. Like, he's not the head honcho, and yet he's also, but he's still presented as the main villain. He's a really bad guy who's having a really bad day. <You know? laughs> So I kind of like how they play that card, no pun intended, with Le Chiffre, which, like, we're explained in the book why he's at Casino Royale. But I think the fact that, as you said, the padding, but part of that padding is really getting to know what kind of a situation Le Chiffre is in. And I think that it doesn't make his actions excusable. He's a dirty scumbag. But you sort of understand the pressures he's dealing with and why he's so desperate. So, and you know, when you're played by Mads Mikkelsen, I mean, the character becomes all the more interesting for it. So I really, really like how they introduce and to a degree develop the character of Le Chiffre, which we don't really get in the book.
No, in the book he's... he's just a pervert. He's not good at math. He's just a pervert.
He's a loser. He's a loser, baby. So why don't you cure me?
Yeah, or in his case, kill him.
Yeah, no kidding. We also have, Vesper Lynd. I hope you gave your parents hell for that. Where do we start with Vesper Lynd? Do we start with Evergreen herself, fantastic actress?
You know, ironically, I've been friends. Well, she says, and I believe her, she was one of my former roommates, was actually friends with Eva Green while growing up in France. I never told you that.
Knowledge bomb. What's going on here?
Well,
tell us more.
One of my old roommates, I don't hang out with her as much as I used to. I haven't seen her in years, actually, but I'm still Facebook friends with her. She back when she was in I guess high school in France, she was friends with her. I'd rather not tell her name on this pod.
We're not asking you to either.
But she, I tend to believe her because I know where she's, what type of family she and Eva Green come from, and I tend to believe her story that yeah, she probably knew her. And no, she says nothing but good things about her. But it's just to me it's ironic because when she found out that I was a big Bond fan, I was watching the movie and she said, "Oh, it's my friend." I'm like, what?
What are you talking about, girl?
What? Yeah. So that's my.
That's awesome. No, I didn't know that. Did you know I met George Lazenby? Huh? What do you think of that?
Yeah, I did. I did too. I think.
Oh.
But no, it's one of my tenuous connections. Oh,
still,
to
that's exciting. I mean, you know someone who
knows someone.
Knows someone famous. I mean, that's still something. You know, I think the case of Vesper Linde is one of. I mean, there's very good writing that goes into the character. So obviously, we'll credit the screenwriters for that. But I also think it's one of those cases where the actor they chose does so much of the heavy lifting. I mean, Eva Green is so good at balancing, I guess, sensitivity with, as Bond describes it, a prickliness. She's so good at that. It's unbelievable. And there's something in her eyes as well. Her eyes waver between sensitivity, but also not
coldness.
Coldness, confidence as well. She is a very complex character. She's hard to read, but not because she's poorly portrayed or written. She's hard to read because of
The actress is portraying someone who has a secret.
Yeah, well, I think that obviously helps a lot, and that's where the writing comes in. But the repartee between her and Bond, it's always very intense. It's always very sharp.
It's what's his name? Robert Haggis?
Paul Haggis, who I think was coming off his Academy Awards for Crash. So his name was very popular at the time. And I think from the reading I did, apparently it was actually I was about to say Neil Purvis and Robert Wade decided to bring, but I don't think it was them. I think I might have been.
Purvis and Wade wrote the script. Paul Haggis polished it.
Yeah, but I can't remember at whose behest. Was it Martin Campbell's who invited him in, or was it maybe Barbara?
I think it's the producers.
Yeah, okay.
Who knows?
That'd be kind of weird. Like, they've been working with Robert and Wade for a few movies.
They still are working with them.
That's
true.
And then they're not working with Paul Haggis anymore. So.
Yeah, my guess is that seeing their work, Purvis and Wade, is that they nail the structure down, but their characters need a little bit to help, need a bit of help. I mean, like I was discussing with you previously, Christmas Jones, somebody forgot something somewhere, somehow.
It's like, a lot of things to forget and a lot of places to forget it.
It's an unfinished character. And for Casino Royale, I think they, I never read their original script. I never will. I'm never going to bother looking for that. But I'd be curious to see how much difference Paul Haggis made on that character. I feel like most of their interaction, the interaction between her and Bond, was his, and are some of the best moments in the movie.
You should read it. If you want me to lend you the book called Some Kind of Hero, I think you were leafing through it earlier, the one that looks like a big brick. The Casino Royale chapters is for plenty of reasons very interesting. Through that book, it's my understanding that Paul Haggis actually came up with the House in Venice sequence.
Oh, really?
I think the original...
That's my least part of the book is that part.
Is that, well, you were saying, oh, you think they nailed down the structure in the original version of the script. And I think you're absolutely right, because that chapter in Some Kind of Hero reveals that, yeah, the movie kind of ended in their little villa. He finds Vesper dead the next morning, and instead of a letter, I think she might have filmed herself or something like that. And he's sort of watching her confess her treachery, and the movie kind of ends like that. And then they brought the script to Paul Haggis, and he is the one that said, you know what, I think we need to really heighten these emotions. We need to squeeze as much juice as we can out of this relationship. And he was right. Again, it's a great action sequence. But funnily enough, they kind of do keep the suicide aspect because she does kill herself.
Oh, God, it's worst. It's the worst. The way she dies is the worst.
It's the worst as in how horrifying it is.
It is horrifying. Yeah, of course. It's disgusting. Like
she's already pretty pale just as a human being, and she looks even paler under that water. It's really she's ghostly kind of.
It's a disturbing way of dying. She kills herself by drowning. As a human being, you're not wired to do that, so it takes. Just the implication and the way she performs that scene is disturbing as hell.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah,
it just like ugh, it ugh, brings shivers down my spine.
And it's again something else that comes across much more clearly in the film as opposed to the book is their appreciation for one another. I feel for Vesper Lynn, I feel the pressure. We were talking about the pressure Le Chiffre is in, but Le Chiffre is the baddie. We don't really care that he did, but we do care about Vesper Lynn. When the more time we spend with her, the more, you know, attractive as a person, the more attractive she becomes, and the more we're happy to see her and Bond together. So when she makes that ultimate decision, like there is only one way this is going to end, it's by me dying. With Bond literally just outside that elevator under the water trying to reach her, it's a heartbreaking moment. It's a really, really rough moment. I also rewatched the film yesterday, and I don't cry much. I don't shed tears at that scene, but you know my heart sort of feels a little something and I've seen this movie God a dozen times, 10 times, so and I still feel that little pang in my heart when she's doing that, because I feel like I've gotten to, unlike in the book, I've gotten to know Vesper. We don't understand why Bond was about to marry Vesper in the book. We can certainly understand why Bond was ready to quit MI6 and spend the rest of his life with Vesper in the film.
She has a personality. They gave her a personality in the
what's that movie. Word?
A personality.
No idea what you're talking about.
Because in the book, she's the Morpheus blob. Whether it's the actress, the writers, Paul, I guess, Purvis Wade or Eva Green or the producers, but maybe all of them together, they gave life to that character that was previously in the other iteration. I've never watched I watched the 60s version of Casino Royale, but
I did too. I have it somewhere here on Blu-ray.
It really doesn't count, and I never watched the TV version.
I've never seen it. Oh, that's going to be another bonus episode, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yes. But compared to the book, that character has no personality. She's just there to comment on things, and you don't understand why Bond falls for her. You don't understand what she is. But Eva Green, I got to know her. I got to feel that she is a real person, and that's it. Just complements the movie.
I can't make up my mind as to what my favorite line of dialogue from her is. It's either, "For as charming as you are, Mr. Bond, I will keep my eye on our government's money and off your perfectly formed ass," or "The dinner jackets and dinner jackets. This is the latter, and I need you looking like a man at that table." I can't pick one. I don't know which one I like more.
I also like when he signs the receipt as James Bond. And she says, "I'm going to take the first one. You take the next one because there's no space for you and your ego in this elevator."
That is a good line.
That's a good line. That is a
very good line.
"Now, having just met you, I wouldn't go as far as calling you a cold-hearted bastard."
"No, of course not.
But it wouldn't be a stretch to imagine."
No, I mean, and you have a wonderful actress delivering it. I've always been a big, since Casino Royale, I've been a big Evergreen fan. I don't think she always chooses the best projects, but she's always very good.
Oh, she's always good.
Yeah, she's very dependable. Unfortunately, you sometimes have to pay $15 to see her in crap, but she's good.
I don't know what you're talking about. Sin City 2.
300 Rise of an Empire.
Oh my God. I saw that in theater. But she's good.
She's very good. I haven't seen... I can't claim to have seen all of her films, but all of the ones I've seen her in, she's never the weak link. She's sometimes the strongest link in a bad film. I believe in our Casino Royale, the book review, you were saying that when you, whenever there's a passage discussing Felix Leiter, you see Jack Lord, which, I mean, an excellent choice. He's a fantastic Felix Leiter in the first film, Dr. No. We get a bit of a different Felix Leiter this time around in Mr. Jeffrey Wright. Now, I think this guy's pretty cool. Hey, I think you got him. We didn't introduce ourselves, seeing as I'm a brother. We're related. I'm a brother from Langley. Like, come on, man. That's a effing good Felix Leiter.
He's my second favorite Bond.
Fair enough.
I mean, there's so... honestly, there are...
Yeah.
I think there are more Felix Leiter than there are Bond.
Yeah, there's an expression in French, l'embarras du choix. I don't know how... I don't know what the English...
embarrassments of richness.
Yeah, it's like, who do you pick? Well, some of them really suck. There are
most
a couple.
Of them have done it once, but...
True. But, you know, amongst the good... My top three Felix Leiters are Jack Lord, Jeffrey Wright, and I've always liked David Hedison, who did it twice.
I did too. When I was younger, I didn't like him, but...
I like him a lot. But Jeffrey Wright, he's climbing up there. I am very tempted to say he's my favorite. I think he's so awesome. Does it look like we need the money? So good.
It's a shame they haven't brought him back for Skyfall or Spectre. He's mentioned Spectre,
and I thought, hey, man, they didn't show him in the marketing. Is Felix back? Like, and no, it's just like pass. I have a friend, Felix.
You know what? Maybe they're gonna do another take on the License to Kill plot, and Monica Bellucci and his character and him are gonna marry. And he's gonna get his leg chopped by a shark, and she's gonna get killed, and License
so
to Kill.
So she will die
Bebo.
After all, because the surprise was that hey, here's a secondary Bond girl that doesn't die. We're gonna kill her anyways. Just wait next movie.
Yeah, if they bring her back, she's dead. She's a goner.
My poor Monica Bellucci. But no, I'm a big fan of Jeffrey Wright's Felix Leiter. But like in the book, there are two people from different spy agencies helping Bond out. The other one here is René Mathis, played by Giancarlo Giannini.
You are better than me because I completely forgot his name.
Giancarlo Giannini, who's an Italian actor.
He was in Hannibal.
I think he was in Hannibal. I think he gets his intestines ripped out of him or something like that. A horrible, horrible death. He's a lot of fun.
He's a fun character.
I think I'll report on this evening's... He doesn't say... He says frivolities.
No, he's there's always the older statesman mentor in a Bond movie.
Your Bays, your Dracos, your Topos, your...
The guy in Dino Day when he goes to Cuba that I don't remember.
Fun character, but I can't remember his name now either.
We'll get there when we get there.
Yeah. Do we have a book based on that? We don't have to review it, do we? There's no Die Another Day book.
There's a book novelization.
Yeah, no, that's a good analogy. The fact that there's this elder character, either mustachioid or bearded, in this case a little of both, who sort of guides Bond through the proceedings. And
has the girl melted your cold heart yet?
I love it. It's not because you are dead that you cannot be useful. You know, there just is so many good lines. I mean, we're cherishing the performances and we're cherishing the charisma of the characters and the actors, but, I mean, credit where credit is due. A lot of this is good writing. I mean, these are really, really good lines. And I think one of the prime examples of that is when Bond first meets Vesper Lynn on the train. You know, I'm the money, every penny of it. And they just go, it's just this tit for tat for about 10 minutes. It just goes on and on and on and on.
I mean, you can't stop watching.
I know. And it's quite incredible because so more often than not, you know, when you want to watch a Bond movie, it's because of the action. It's because of the locations, the explosions. But here's a Bond movie where the locations are great, the explosions are fantastic, the stunts are wonderful, but the dialogue sequences are really
everything's
good.
Running on all cylinders. It's a perfect. Oh, that's why it's my favorite Bond movie. I mean, Craig's not my favorite Bond portrayal, but the movies are probably among my favorites.
Yeah, he has a very good batting record. We'll eventually get to our rankings of the films at some point down the road. But yeah, his batting average is really high.
Yeah.
Hopefully it'll remain high. We'll see, and I'll find that out in a couple of years. I want to talk a little bit about M, a character, a very important character in any Bond film, but kind of an important one in this one as well. Speaking of mentors and motherly mother figures, kind of, sort of.
Did I mention the ironic thing about Fleming? How his relationship with his mother was really messed up? Because when her husband Fleming's father died, I think in the First World War, his testament actually, he wrote a clause that if she remarried, she would not get any money from his estate, so she couldn't remarry. But she still had affairs with multiple men. And the Fleming boys, both Ian and Peter, had a really contentious relationship with her, and they started calling just their mother M. So that's when you know that, and you see you know about that, and you watch the movies, especially in Skyfall, it's even more implied that he sees her as a mother, but. Yeah, it's a different relationship that even Pierce Brosnan had. It's not the same character as in the Brosnan era.
No, the Judi Dench version of M in the Brosnan era, it's a little different because she's a woman, but she's kind of just the female version of the M we've already seen.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Judi Dench M in the Daniel Craig era. And probably because Casino Royale is a, quote, origin story, it creates that different dynamic. You know, Bond needs some kind of guidance. Now, he doesn't necessarily heed that guidance, at least not until the end of the film. But little moments like, you know, well, I knew you were you, and stuff like that, I think this M shows a kind of wisdom. In a sense, she shows a kind of wisdom and an understanding of character that maybe Judi Dench's or Bernard Lee's or whoever, that M as an entity in the franchise hadn't shown in the past. I think in that sense, she's definitely a very different character in this film. And Judi Dench and Daniel Craig are back and forth, obviously very different from that between him and Evergreen. But it's really good too. I like the scene where he shows her, he infiltrates, big breaks in.
Yeah, he breaks into her home.
My goodness, I had no idea M was not a randomly signed. Oh, no, I thought it was a randomly signed letter. I had no idea it stood for utter one more word and I'll have you shot.
Utter one syllable, one more syllable and I'll have you shot.
Just so good. It's so sharp. We're going back to the dialogue yet again. We can't seem to escape it.
But it's such great dialogue. I mean, it's hard to get away, but even then, there's great actions, not only like the previously mentioned parkour sequence, but the entire Miami airport sequence is quite thrilling. It is, can I say Hitchcockian a little bit? There's just a bit between Dimitrios and Bond when they're at the Body World exhibit, and he's looking for him, and he's not finding him, and just because of the location, to me, the Body World exposition, whichever you prefer, it feels Fleming-ish. There's a little bit macabre, grotesque. There's something that just feels it comes from the novels, and it doesn't, obviously. But it is a perfect location for a sequence in a Bond movie.
It's a perfect location for a particularly grisly death.
Oh,
and a quiet death too. Nobody else around knows what's going on.
It's perfect.
It's great. In our previous episode, when we talked about the book, we talked about Baccarat. Here we're talking about Texas Hold'em Poker, which is a game I don't really understand.
I'm not going to spend this episode to tell you how it plays, but
that's another bonus. I don't think that's another bonus episode. I hope that's not another bonus episode. Okay, so you're reading about Baccarat. It lasts about 20 pages, and the game is done. Film is a visual medium. So let's talk about how the filmmakers, director Campbell and everybody else, how do they have... I think they
pull it off in spades.
I think it really, really looks awesome. It's a little bit annoying when Mathis is hush-hushing to Vesper. Oh, $14 million in the pot. It's like, we know there's 14. But other than those little moments, I think they do a pretty good job of it.
Mathis is essential for some. I'm feeling for somebody who doesn't know poker, he's probably super essential because you
wouldn't. He's saying stuff like, he's calling his bluff. I think, I don't know poker. I know he's trying to call his bluff.
But, you know, it's a great choice when they pick poker over Baccarat. Not only is it extremely popular still to this day, it's an easy game to pick up, but also it's not completely dependent on luck. And there's an element of chance, obviously. It's not gambling for nothing. But you're not playing against the house. You're against other players. And depending on the odds on your cards and the people, there's a strategy. You can pick up on other people's patterns or just the way they behave. If they get too excited.
Play the cards. You play the man across from you.
That's actually rather proper. Like, I'm not the greatest poker player. I enjoy a good friendly home game. I wouldn't play in the casino because you get to play with people who play for a living.
High rollers. High rollers.
I think it's high rollers.
High rollers.
I would try at least once. Eventually I will try to play the casino just to get a real feel for it. But it's not the same. Okay, a friendly game at home, it's exciting, and it's just as exciting as it's shown in the movie. It's a fun game, and it's easy to pick up. It's very simple. The strategies can be limited to depending on the number of players that you play with, because from what I gathered from the experience I've had, the less players there are, the more aggressive sometimes you have to be. You have to put more in the pot. That's why eventually when it comes to also depending on the rules, you get a time. Each time you complete a turn, you have to increase the small blind because you have basically an initial amount that you have to invest, and somebody else has the big blind, which is double that initial amount, and everyone else can decide whether or not they want to invest in the game or not, depending on the cards they got. Mm-hmm. So there's always, you have at least two people that have a vested interest in playing or not. So that's why there's a little bit, it's a fun green.
You seem really thrilled explaining I'm sure it is.
I'm talking about it, I'm thinking about it, I'm like, oh God, it's been such a long time. I feel like I could play some poker right about now. But no, it's a great pick. I love that particular game, and I love poker movies. There aren't that many, but there's Rounders and Casino Royale are probably my two favorites. But yeah, it's such a great game. Honestly, I want to get myself
a big smile on your face.
But I want to get a poker mat, but I want a custom one that says Casino Royale in the middle.
I've been on eBay. I'm on the cusp of buying an old DVD of Casino Royale that comes with a poker set, and the cards have poker Casino Royale on them.
I have.
If you can buy it before I do, go for it.
No, I already own that.
Oh, you already own that.
I own that poker set.
Is it a good set?
Well, you know, the poker set or just the cards?
I think it's just the cards.
The cards I own.
But who cares about the
cards? But there's a poker set, but that thing is like $300. Really? Yeah, it's that thing. You need a pretty penny.
I'll start with the poker. I'll start with the cards.
I just start with the cards.
I never opened the package.
mint on card, literally.
You know, the game in the book doesn't last very long. The game in the film, I mean, timeline-wise, it lasts a couple of days. In the running length of the film, it lasts a long time because they're trying to kill this guy like left and right, James Bond is.
At least two main attempts on his life. There's the previously mentioned African freedom fighters.
Yes. Or terrorists, depends on what your political allegiance lies.
Or Valenka.
Yes.
And I know her name.
Very good. I had Malacca. I would not have remembered Valenka. So one to one. That's a really awesome scene, by the way. It goes back to Lushif being a bit of a jerk.
Even her, she's cold. He just saved their. Well, her.
Yeah. She kind of gives him a kiss, then says sorry, and it's like, oh yeah, you called your boyfriend. I guess he's not that much of a jerk. She caught him up so he could potentially get jacked. Like, yeah, I'm not going to save your arm, bitch.
Yeah, that's true.
But, yeah, and then there's, so there, that leads to the stairwell fight. Another big moment for Vesper. That puts her into a slightly state of shock later on. But the fight itself is so aggressive. It's really violent.
At one point, the Walter PPK, almost like as a sword. Like he blocks the machete with it. It's a brilliant move.
Yeah, I mean, it's those survival skills kicking in once again. So that's one death-defying escapade during the card game or during a break in the card game. The other one is, I guess it's the film's answer to the cane gun is the poison in the martini, which is an awesome scene.
One thing I never realized what he was doing, and it's my brother that told me. My brother told me that trick, and my brother at one point was a heavy drinker during his college years. And the first time he notices that he's getting sick, he goes to the bathroom, and he picks up the salt and glass. And I'm going to use a French term that my brother told me, but he's doing a rince cochon. Like he's putting the salt in the water just to get himself to throw up.
It's very easy to miss, but before they cut away from the bathroom, he is putting his head down into the sink and going, ugh. But the movie cuts away so quickly that he don't really pick up on it. But that is what he's doing. He's trying to make himself throw up and get rid of some of that poison, I guess.
But my brother gave me that tip. I was not aware of that.
Rince cochon, ladies and gentlemen, look it up.
Yeah, rince cochon. I don't know if it's a legit word. That might be my brother's invention, but probably, but maybe not.
He sort of desperately makes it back to his Aston Martin DBS, I think.
Yes.
The little defibrillator, it's such a really moment. I love the moment where. He's listening, I guess, little headphones or whatever, and he's in contact with the doctors at MI6 and, you know, please listen to everything I'm saying. I'm all ears. Like, even as he's losing his breath.
On the verge of death.
There's a little quip in there. I'm all ears. And, of course, who comes to save the day?
Vesper.
How could she not save the day? She can save me from my heart stop. Or she, unfortunately, I'm afraid she wouldn't make my heart stop if she walked up in front of me. But that's a nice little moment, too, where, because we do find out that, you know, she is a traitor. Ultimately, she's not helping Bond, but she helps.
She Bond doesn't want to have him.
Exactly. So, and I think that actually, when you're watching the film for the first time, it's like a cool moment. When you're watching it for the second time, it's like, she's a good person, but she just picked the wrong team.
Well, she's been coerced.
That's true. Very true. Well, coerced, but then like covertly coerced, because it's not really true. Anyway, we'll get to Quantum of Solace.
Yeah, that's
we'll get to that. We'll cross that bridge when we get. Or we'll blow up that bridge when we get to it. All depending on our opinions. But you're not going back into that game. Wouldn't dream of it. And goes back into the game. This is a wonderful, wonderful moment. So yeah, no, the whole sequence of the card game and the way it's shot. I rewatched the film yesterday, and that's just a really well lit scene. I find
it's very moody.
The set looks fantastic, and there's some great shots. I swear, I just picked on some of these shots yesterday, despite God knows how many times I watched it. There's a shot where Felix is predominantly in the foreground, but there's enough space to his right and his left behind him. Or you see Vesper and Mathis walking towards the right, and you see the bald guy that works for the shift like walking to the left. I'm like, huh? Okay, you got to watch the movie a few times to pick up on that. But that's clever cinematography. That's really, really cool. I would have to guess that for people that don't care too much about cards, you know, they try to offer as much assassination attempts or eye candy to make it as interesting as possible.
No, they have to make it. That's the problem with any card game. You have to make it look dynamic. If not, people are going to get bored. But the funny thing that you mentioned is that the way Bond wins the last end is the same as he does when he plays against Demetrios when he gets the Aston Martin at the beginning of the movie. Because in poker, there's an additional draw of three cards. You get, each individual player gets their pair of cards, and after that, they flip three cards. And depending on what you have, some you might have a great hand because you need the complementary mental cards to complete your set. And but the thing is that Bond, from the get go on that play, he has the best hand at the beginning, but he never bets. He lets the other players always bet big, but he never does. He lets the other player get cocky with and overplay their hand, and then he goes, yeah.
So he didn't change his cards. He let everybody else change their cards. Is that like the suivi?
When you go suivi, depending on the amount of money, let's say I bid, and you're going to have to suivi, or you can bid more, and then I have to follow you. And if I don't,
I can call or I can raise.
You can call and you can raise. Mm. So in his case, at the beginning of the play, when they threw the communal cards, he knew he was winning, but he let the other player get.
I never picked up on that, actually.
No, it's something you
you would pick up if you knew poker.
Eventually, on your 17th viewing of the movie and knowing a little bit of poker, you notice those things. But
there are two moments for Le Chiffre during the poker sequences that I like. The first one is when technically he beats Bond. It's always the winner that shows their cards last. He shows one of them, then he flips the other one, and he just goes, oops. I thought that's a really funny one. And the second moment I like is, obviously, he is next to last to show his cards because Bond will show his last because he's going to win. But Le Chiffre looks at his cards, and he does, I guess he must be so sure of winning that he thinks Bond is insane to raise because he goes like, and he's sort of like, is this sort of bizarre, uncomfortable laugh? Like, is this guy serious? Like, is he really raising when I have these cards? This guy's insane. I'm going to beat him a second time. It's very like snobbish, overconfident laugh. Like, this kid is dead. I love those two moments. Again, Mads Mikkelsen, we salute you. Hannibal. So, speaking of Hannibal, there's another Hannibal. We have two Hannibal connections in this episode.
Yes. Oh my God. I just realized that. Oh, clever. Mm. There's another part in the poker game that I like is when he orders the famous drink.
Vesper. My goodness, yes. I think I know what you're going to say.
Because everyone, when he orders it, everyone at the table gets one. except for Jeffrey Wright. He says, keep the fruit.
Friend, I have one of those, but keep the fruit.
3 measures of Gordon's, 1 of vodka, 1/2 measure of quinoa lily, shake it over rice, and then add a thin slice of lemon peel.
Yes, sir.
You know, I'll have one of those. So will I.
It's not that late. My friend, bring me one as well. Keep the fruit. That's it?
It's my goodness. We could, you know what? I think we stop reviewing the film and we just quote the movie. This is turning into one of those podcasts, which I have no problem because we're quoting.
Quote Zeno Royale.
We have quips to spare and puns to spare as well, ladies and gentlemen. So we've gone through the characters, we've gone through the plot, obviously rather thoroughly. I'd say. Do we want to maybe talk about what was going on at the time culturally or anything like that? We might not have as much to say as we did during our Casino Royale book review.
Yeah. It's been only 11 years.
Yeah.
And Daniel Craig's still James Bond. It doesn't feel like it's weird. Been that long.
That being said, I think I briefly mentioned this before we hit the record button. I think, you know, we'll get to Quantum of Solace, but I still think in certain ways, I think 2 Jason Bourne films had come out by then. And Quantum of Solace has bigger issues in that regard, but certainly the sort of taciturn approach to Daniel Craig's performance, his approach to that character, does kind of reflect the cold and distant Jason Bourne. You know, we're talking about double agents, we're talking about terrorism, we're talking about, you know, bankers and governments getting involved. I feel there's a little bit of Jason Bourne in there.
It is. It's a. It, even though it's not the first Bond movie after 9/11, I think it bears to mention that's the first one that feels it's like it's commenting on the. Yeah. They even in there's a line of dialogue where they implicate Le Chiffre in that terrorist act.
I think they do. I think it's when they're this is after Solange is murdered. It's the next morning, and M is sort of briefing him on. At that point, I don't think he knows, or maybe he's heard of Le Chiffre, but now she's really explaining who this guy is and what his background is. Bit of a mathematical genius, but she does mention 9/11 at some point.
Somebody made a killing after 9/11, something
like that. Yeah. That's true. So they do sort of tie it into, you know what, 2006. We're 5 years after 9/11, which, you know, for obvious reasons was a major event politically. And I think it also started really influencing cinema as well. I think maybe that's where the popularity of the Bourne films came out. Conspiracies, who's right, who's
paranoia.
Wrong. Paranoia. And I think that, to a degree, certainly influenced this Bond reboot.
Everything's taken a little bit more seriously. There's more gravitas to our fiction. I mean,
He bleeds,
yeah. But just like Bond, they rebooted the Batman franchise, and it was taken much seriously with the Nolan films than previously with Burton or Schumacher, which would be turned into farces, kind of like Pierce Brosnan's movie. By the end, you had space lasers and people changing their race with diamonds in their face. And they went from that extreme to something that feels like it could actually happen in the real world.
Yeah, no, it's true. I agree that. And there aren't very many Bond films. We can probably name a couple more. But it's certainly one of the few that seems to, you know, while being very sexy and very attractive to look at and having explosions left and right, despite those ingredients which make it a Bond film, it is one of those few Bond adventures that it feels like they're making a deliberate effort to ground it as much as possible within the context of a Bond film. There's always going to be a little bit of heightened stuff. There's a whole video on YouTube about how the house in Venice couldn't have floated for that. I've watched that video. You need to understand a little bit of mathematics and architecture to really get it. And I'm average in math, and I don't do architecture. But you know, stretching logic aside, stretching reality aside, it does feel like a proper post 9/11 Bond film, which I don't think anybody saw coming. I certainly didn't. I don't think a lot of people did too.
Even after, I remember I did, I used to be able, back in college, I did a bunch of presentations, and I always used pop culture as a reference. I always snuck pop culture in my presentation in a way, so I didn't have to do the research. And one of the presentation was on James Bond. And I made the statement, they'll never do a James Bond where James Bond fights terrorism, and I'll be always people with giant space lasers. It's never going to be taken seriously.
Did the professor retcon your grade from A to F?
Yeah, no. Actually, I got a good grade because I don't remember how I made my point, but I did make a point that from the past, they've always kept themselves rather distant to real events. They never use a Smursh as villains in the movies.
Not really. One time it is briefly mentioned, but they're not the villain. They're not the villain.
It's so they always taken this alternate view of things. It's never real life, but with under the Daniel Craig tenure, they've tried to keep things a little bit more grounded. And I was wrong when I made that prediction. I was wrong.
Yeah, but you know, sure, you were wrong. But I mean, A, it's difficult to predict the future. B, other than those very, very first Connerys, which kind of invented this whole spy action genre, sort of Roger Moore onward, whether something in the news, whether something in popular culture, or something of political significance, the Bond movies do have a habit of putting their own spin on things, whether it's their own spin on a blaxploitation film, yeah, or their own spin on what a post 9/11 world would be like, and what kind of a villain does Bond face in a post 9/11 world. you know, completely different. Blaxploitation, 9/11. Not talking about the same thing. The Bond franchise puts its own spin on those two things. So in that sense, it wasn't new. But I think 9/11 was such a sensitive, like, earth-shattering moment that to see James Bond take that on, you know, in a roundabout way. I mean, 9/11 is briefly uttered, I think, in one or two scenes. But just everything surrounding the villain's plot and who he works for, you know, it, there is that paranoia and that those conspiracies behind it. So yeah, it's
that's something that's also in the novel. I mean, the Cold War, all the spying, the nuclear secrets, the Rosenbergs, all of that was something that was in the zeitgeist when those books were the first book was written. And I think similar events might, well, if not influence, but repeat them themselves in a way in real life. All the paranoia after 9/11, the spying, the infiltration of, in this case, in the current case, not secret spy organization, but basically terrorist organization. There's something similar.
Or as we'll learn in a few movies.
Yeah, something.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
Far more sinister.
Right.
But yeah, no, there's a context of 9/11 truly influenced. But also culturally, the Batman movies, the Jason Bourne movies, he doesn't use any gadgets that are far-fetched. I mean,
that feels like a Jason Bourne influence, though, honestly. I mean, Jason Bourne kills someone with a magazine, you know. that's the kind of James Bond we get in this film. He doesn't kill someone with a magazine, but he probably could.
Yeah, he probably
given
could.
That kind of a given the kind of Bond we have here.
No, he kills a man with a nail gun.
That's true. That's a pretty darn good substitute, and not through his good eye. Through the eye patch.
Oh God!
that's a wonderful thing. Oh, he also electrocutes the dude before he takes the wire that's hanging in. That's pretty awesome. That's pretty badass.
Yeah,
that's a terrible way to go. Why is Bond not getting any shocks? There's electricity flying all over. He's just as wet as the other guy.
He's
Bond.
He's
not gonna die. You can't kill Bond.
Rubber souls.
Sure. For the book, we sort of took a look at what they didn't bring to the film. Have you been doing any reading about what might have been in the film but didn't make it? I did. I found some things, but not as much as I would have thought.
The only thing I can discuss is a completely different, an alternate version of that film that was proposed. It probably would never materialize, but at one point, allegedly, Pierce Brosnan and Quentin Tarantino were trying to pitch a version of Casino Royale to Barbara and Michael.
But they never got to the script stage. It was an idea. Like, they met, they wanted to do it, but they never sat down to write it. I'd be
curious to see if Quentin Tarantino... his computer, if somehow there was a few pages, like he must, if he proposed this deal to Barbara and Michael, if he introduced them to Quentin Tarantino in a way, they must have worked an outline. Like, that's something that probably was done with a lot of alcohol at his mansion in Hollywood Hills, but I'm sure they must have, oh yeah, we'll write that scene, blah blah blah.
Can you imagine the torture scene where he gets his thunderballs rocked? Just how, for every one swing of the carpet beater, 5 minutes of I'm sure great dialogue, but 5 minutes of dialogue for every swing of I don't know if he would be able to make it fun, because Quentin Tarantino can be very funny when he wants to be. Would he be able to make it fun? Because I think it's actually pretty funny.
So. I have an idea for you.
Go ahead.
If Michael Madsen plays Le Chiffre. I know he's...
Probably would have happened, actually.
He was in the previous movie as another character, but screw that. We're recasting.
My answer to you, Joe Don Baker. For Whittaker and then Jack Wade. Done. Who cares? No one cares about those details. But I could actually see that. Not Mads Mikkelsen.
Stuck in the middle with you.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna stick something in the middle of you if you don't give me the password, Mr. Bond.
He would have put that would have been great. Just a pop song, but a real something very incongruous, and it would have worked.
It could have worked. Well, certainly in the hands of Tarantino. Again, you know, Bond is one of those franchises where, you know, there are the people, and presume, you know, people that probably are either A, tired of it by now, or B, have never really liked it to begin with, that, oh no, do something super, super, super different. And I'm always on the fence about those things. It's like, yeah, in a fantasy world, I wonder what the Tarantino version would be like, but do I want an official Eon Productions Tarantino James Bond film? I'm not sure I do.
You know what? I just thought of something else. Uma Thurman as Vesper Lynn.
I kind of like her. I'll take Eva Green any day of the week over her. Yeah. But I do like
Uma Thurman. But now you take Uma Thurman, she has to play British. And
no.
Well, if you...
Make her Felix Leiter's ally. I mean, we're changing the story a little bit here, but still, it doesn't matter.
Okay. You're right. She could be English. Not English. American. American. I don't know. I worked so hard when I was rereading the book not to picture Eva Green. Now you're asking me to picture.
I am asking you to do that.
Uma Thurman with Pierce Brosnan, and my brain doesn't want to. It's melting in my ears.
Fair enough. But that's an interesting one. I tried, I do have a couple books at my disposal. I'm sure you have even more than that. But I didn't really land on really interesting nuggets. The Some Kind of Hero book mentions there might have been a little bit of Hildebrand rarity, and there were Dimitrios would have been sort of the Milton Crest of the film and stuff like that, but nothing.
Kills fishes with poison?
I don't even think they got into that much detail, but it didn't seem there would have been. They liked Purvis and Wade like 007 in New York, where he's supposed to meet someone named Solange at some sort of a zoo in New York, and there would have been an action sequence in there, some sort of a reptile museum of some sort. But I didn't, unless there might be a resource that I didn't use that has more information, but I didn't pick up as much as I would have liked, like the alternate version of Casino Royale. We did talk about the ending, Paul Haggis adding to the ending, but that's the evolution of the actual script. Real alternate version. I didn't get that much, actually, unfortunately.
The only things I could remember from that's from that time when the movie was being made, and the people were discussing the casting of Daniel Craig and Craig not Bond, all this bullshit from back in the
madness.
But the other people like screen tested for the part, I don't remember any of them, unfortunately. But I remember that there was a gentleman who's quite much taller than any. Like the guy was allegedly like 6'4" to play Bond, and I was like, wow, he was more like a stuntman type of person, but. Hmm. I would have to roam the internet and find.
I know some of those names. Now, again, my sources are confidential.
Okay.
But, no, I'm joking. But no, I've read in a few places that the Australian guy who was in those Clash of the Titans films, he was in the running. Sam Worthington.
Oh my God.
The Superman du jour, Henry Cavill, was in the running. He would have been really young because he's barely in his mid 30s now. He would have been really young.
Yeah. Well, if they wanted a younger Bond.
That's true. Sam Worthington, Henry Cavill, and there was somebody, you know, now I can't remember, but there was a third name where I read it and I was like, really? That guy was. And these are, we're talking about like the final five. Like Daniel Craig is like on the cusp of getting it, and so are they. But yeah, Henry Cavill, Sam Worthington. Unfortunately, I put my book away. I don't want to pause the recording just for that. But there was another name that was interesting. But Henry Cavill really stood out. I like Henry Cavill. I'm glad we have Daniel Craig.
Mm-hmm.
And Superman will never be James Bond. He's Superman. He's already spoken for. You think so?
Well, probably not. But I wish he would.
He's also English. Like, hello.
Yeah, You know, have you seen The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Yes, I did. It's adequate.
It's
It's popcorn. It was fluff.
In the movie itself, but he's great in the film. Like, he's super charming.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, oh, Jesus. Why? Why did you...
He could be James Bond. Oh, no, we agree. He could be James Bond. I'm just saying, I don't think they want to hire Superman.
No, they'll never hire Superman, unfortunately. I wish he never played Superman. That's probably...
You're not alone. I don't mind him as Superman. We're getting off topic here. I don't mind him as Superman, but you're not the only one to say that.
No, I don't mind him as Superman, but I think he if I have to sacrifice him as Superman...
Him as James Bond?
I'd rather him play James Bond.
Yeah, no, me too. He's a really good... He's a very charismatic actor. I think he'd pull it off in spades.
Yeah.
Is there anything else we want to add to our gushing of Casino Royale?
If you haven't watched the movie while you're listening to this, and if you like the movie, maybe you can listen to our previous episode... Imagining that we have more episodes in the future than this one,
because we have more recordings.
We should have more. Look in our podcast feed. We should have more episodes eventually. If we don't, we'll have, depending when you listen to this. I guess you can go on our website at thejamesbondcomplex.com.
It's a wonderful, wonderful website. I'm just imagining it now. It's just such an awesome place to visit.
It is the best place. There's tons of stuff. You get activities for kids. It's great.
Learn how to play poker. Poker lessons online.
Just a sidetrack. Do you know? I'm going to ask you. Do you know how to make a bow tie?
A bow tie? No.
Okay. I'll keep that as a tease. I'll do a video on it eventually. But every man knows how to tie a bow tie, and then I'm going to tease you with this.
Well, I enjoy being the exception to the rule, Matthew. I don't know. And since you said every man knows, I don't want to know how to tie a bow tie.
You know. Unfortunately, you know.
So where can people find us online? I'm on Twitter at @OOH_pop. That stands for 00pop.
I'm on Twitter at Matt Auclair. Also, I have my personal Facebook page at Matt Auclair. I have to verify that because I don't remember my handle. Basically, Google my name, Matthew Auclair. There's two or three of us. I'm usually in the top research, so you can find me there.
Wonderful. And so what are we doing? I was about to say next week, but
next episode,
next time. Yeah, let's remain vague
on
next
the James time. Bond complex.
Like, we're going back to a book. Possibly? We're going to
We are going back to Fleming, since we're doing this in order.
Yes, sequential order of the release of the novels, not of the films. Hence, why we're suddenly talking about the 21st movie,
and then we're going to talk about the 8th film.
Yeah,
this episode, the one after. The James Bond complex will return in Live and Let Die, 1954.
À la
Au revoir.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.